Good afternoon. Welcome to the second lecture. I'm going to pick up where I left off yesterday, talking about what happened after Richard Dyer's Stars and Heavenly Bodies had been published. So hopefully you'll remember that yesterday I took you through about 30 years of star studies history, from about 1957 through to 1987. And today I'm going to pick up from the early 90s and take you through more or less to the present day. So after it was published, Stars became one of the most quoted books in film studies. Many other studies of stars and stardom were published, picking up where Richard Dyer left off. Many of these could be described as Dyerian, in that they stuck largely to the ideas and methods of Richard Dyer's books, while expanding his theories to different stars and different national cinemas other than Hollywood. By the 1990s, it was clear that two branches of Dyerian star studies had developed. The first involved a more in-depth investigation into the part played by audiences in terms of how they engage with stars. That would include Jackie Stacey's book Stargazing. And the second branch looked at a more detailed examination of stardom in terms of the industrial processes of stardom, how the star system ran in the film industry. And a good example of that would be Paul McDonald's Star Studies, published for Wallflower Press in 2000. Now, before investigating these two divergent routes through star studies, it's worth noting that Christine Gledhill's edited collection of essays, Stardom, Industry of Desire, marked an important moment in the development of star studies, in which, for the first time, various influential and important works were brought together in one publication, providing not just a synthesis of different academic approaches to stardom, but more interestingly, putting these into what the editor called a dynamic relationship. By doing this, this eclectic collection of studies sought to promote and preserve the diversity of film scholarship on stars in an inclusive and open-minded framework, with an emphasis on commonality between the individual essays and star scholars, stressing the connections and correspondences, as well as the disagreements and departures. Okay. Now, Christine Gledhill's book Stardom drew together works that were variously informed by sociological, semiological, and psychoanalytic approaches. But what was not explicitly acknowledged at the time of the publication was that, although it's very clear to us now when we look back at it, is the extent to which this collection of work represents the beginnings of what has become known as new film history, a turn away from theory, big theory, psychoanalytic theory in particular, to history and a new engagement with history that's theoretically informed. And this really begins to happen by the mid-1980s. Several of the essays that appear in Stardom, an Industry of Desire, were actually taken from the film journal Wide Angle, from a particular issue published in 1985. And it was that journal, Wide Angle, an American film journal, that was at the forefront of disseminating historical studies that both incorporated theory and challenged or significantly revised existing historical accounts, particularly accounts of the beginnings of the film industry, and that would include the beginnings of the star system. Consequently, many of the essays included in Stardom question previous historical research in order to revisit and rethink some of the key areas of film history closely related to Stardom. Most notably, the essays by Janet Steiger, American film historian, Richard Cordova, another American film historian, Charlotte Herzog and Jane Gaines, who collaborated on a piece together investigating the economics of the film industry. So it was this collection of essays that Jackie Stacey first published her research on female film stars. This was something she had embarked upon in the late 1980s when she set out to investigate the relationship between British women and Hollywood female stars of the 1940s and 50s. Here she examined the roles played by fashion, beauty products, particularly those endorsed and promoted by film stars, and also the processes of ordinary people copying film stars, imitating them, as a key part of their relationship as fans with their favourite stars. So Jackie Stacey's essay, Feminine Fascinations, Forms of Identification in Star Audience Relations, appears as chapter 12 in Christine Gledhill's Stardom book. And it actually begins with a quotation from Richard Dyer's Stars, noting the conspicuous absence of the audience, both from his own book and from film studies more generally. So Jackie Stacey is directly responding to that absence and that call by Dyer to say, we need to do more work on stars and audiences, how audiences relate to stars. And that's precisely what she does. She picks up the baton, if you like, in this essay. So Stacey notes the importance of audience research for feminist film scholars in particular, and especially those concerned to challenge assumed notions of passivity on the part of the female audiences. She even declares her own desire to discover more about the relationship between female audiences and her own desires, between female audiences and their relationship to stars, a desire which drove her to place advertisements in two leading women's magazines, British weekly magazines, in search of readers willing to write about their favourite stars of the 40s and 50s. And those two advertisements elicited 300 replies. She received 300 letters telling her about their fascination with Hollywood stars in the 40s and 50s. And for her, this testified to the continuing significance of Hollywood stars in women's lives and imaginations, 50 years beyond the period at which they became fans of those stars. Stacey noted with surprise the absence of feminist work on Hollywood stars and on audiences compared to genre, narrative and spectatorship. She also noted that there was very little feminist work on stars which had been carried out by this time, and what there was largely based on textual analysis, on reading images of women, such as Molly Haskell's work, or the woman as image constructed by the patriarchal text in the work of Laura Mulvey, which I'm presuming you're familiar with. She therefore concluded, and I quote, that little attention has been paid to female stars in Hollywood by feminist film theorists outside the ways in which the stars function in the film text. However, Stacey did point out that a number of feminist scholars had brought together textual analysis with ethnographic investigation, so actually researching audiences themselves and asking them direct questions, or with historical contextualization of audiences. And she points in particular to the work of Jane Gaines, for instance, and in particular her article War, Women and Lipstick, Fan Magazines in the 40s, published in 1986. Finally, Stacey noted the importance of Dyer's research conducted for his book Heavenly Bodies, which involved him discussing the responses he had received to an advertisement from gay men about their attachment to Judy Garland. Stacey went on to describe various methods of obtaining research information about audiences, including her own methods of asking women to write about their memories of stars from previous decades, asking women to reflect upon and write about, produce narratives of what they remember about gazing at stars 40 or 50 years before. And having done that, having talked in depth about her methodology, she then goes on to describe what such accounts reveal to her about the nature of British women's identification with Hollywood female stars of that period. And she discusses the various accounts which create a very different conception of cinematic identification from those generated from psychoanalytic film theory, particularly feminist psychoanalytic film theory, noticing how diverse those processes are. 3 years later, Stacey provided a much more extensive account of her research into British fans of female Hollywood stars in her book Stargazing, which I believe some of you, if not all of you, are familiar with. This was published in 1994. Here she combined psychoanalytic theories of spectatorship with cultural studies, particularly those cultural studies of television audiences, again using ethnographic methodologies, in order to investigate the ways in which the psychic investments are grounded in specific historical and cultural contexts. She did this, moreover, by examining and interpreting the letters and questionnaires of white British women over the age of 60, detailing their memories of Hollywood female stars from the 1940s and 50s, so the period mainly during and after the Second World War. In so doing, Stacey introduced to star studies a greater range of theories and methodologies associated with cultural studies. This was one of the first major attempts to use ethnographic methods as the basis of a star study, and also one of the first to confine itself to an investigation into a fairly narrowly defined cultural or historical moment. And out of this emerged some valuable work on memory, on nostalgia, on escapism, identification, desire, consumption, and consumerism, as well as raising issues of knowledge and taste. So it's a very groundbreaking work in a lot of ways, inspired by Richard Dyer's Heavenly Bodies, particularly his essay on Judy Garland. Now, when in 1998, 4 years later, Routledge republished Richard Dyer's Stars book, almost 20 years after its original publication, this new edition featured a supplementary chapter by Paul MacDonald at the end of the book, in which the author assessed the extent to which the various avenues opened up by Dyer for film scholars had been pursued in different ways. And here MacDonald noted four main areas in which star studies had developed over the past 20 years since the publication of Stars by the BFI, British Film Institute, in 1979. So particularly stars and history had become a major branch of this theory. Star bodies and performance had become another major strand. Stars and audiences had become another major strand. And then finally, stardom as labour, as capital, industry studies, looking at contractual arrangements between stars and studios, became the fourth major strand. So that's how things had really developed from 1979 to 1998. Now, noting a renewed interest in history within film studies, MacDonald pointed out that scholars of cinema had both re-examined the origins of the star system in American cinema and historicised stardom, for instance, by examining the social circumstances of a star's significance. And in particular, MacDonald cites Richard de Cordova's book, Picture Personalities, published in 1990, as a key example of particularly the historicisation of early American cinema and the birth of the star system. Okay. Now, the context really for MacDonald's own essay included in Stars in 1998, was one in which he recognised that the kind of spirit of that time, the spirit of the late 90s, was a particular interest in star bodies, which had really grown out of and been inspired by Yvonne Tasker's book, Spectacular Bodies. And this had a direct impact on a lot of film scholars who were working on stardom at this time. And particularly the notion of the way in which certain kinds of stars could quite literally embody historical moments or social types. And in terms of Yvonne Tasker's work, this was directly associated with looking at the action, the muscular action-bound heroes of American cinema, such as Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay, other influential works, though, that had appeared included studies of acting, such as James Naramore's Acting in the Cinema from 1988, and also a whole series of essays by Barry King, but perhaps most notably his two essays, Stardom as an Occupation and The Star as a Commodity. Strangely, Barry King's never actually published a book on stardom, even though he wrote his PhD on stardom in the early 1980s. And it was a very groundbreaking PhD in lots of ways. But what he has done is he's published parts of that PhD as essays and book chapters in different places, and I'll be drawing on some of those over the next few days. Okay. Perhaps one of the most important things really offered by Barry King's research has been the notion of two different kinds of film performer, film stars. Those stars who are associated with what he calls personification, which is where an actor has a strong star identity, like Marilyn Monroe, who always effectively plays herself in film after film, or compared to another star who he talks about in terms of impersonation, who's the kind of star, a bit like Laurence Olivier, who would disappear into his character, and you kind of forget you're watching the star, and you concentrate on the different types of characters he becomes subsumed by in role after role. So Barry King really gives us this very useful tool of impersonation and personification as two different types of star in terms of how they relate to characterization and acting. Okay. Another really influential text who both Jackie Stacey and Paul McDonald draws on a lot is Jane Gaines, the American film historian, who's more recently set up the Women Pioneers Women's History Project, which is a global project now. But back in the early 90s, she produced a book called Contested Culture, which looked at all the legal contractual arrangements between stars and studios. And it's the first time somebody had really looked at those contractual arrangements. And I'll come back to that again. Another important author, influential in terms of Paul McDonald's work, was Gorham Kingdom, who'd also produced an anthology called The American Movie Industry, The Business of Motion Pictures. And again, it's an economic look at the film industry in Hollywood. So these are the key texts that are informing this more historical branch of star studies that is beginning to emerge in and around 1998, 1999. Okay. The other thing that starts to happen around this time, certainly from the year 2000, is an increasing move away from Hollywood in star studies to refocus on Europe in particular, and from Europe, the rest of the world. So in 2000, Jeanette Van Sandoz published her book entitled Stars and Stardom in French Cinema. And in so doing, she extended the borderlines of star studies further beyond Hollywood. Here she noted that, and I quote, "In most people's view, stars mean Hollywood stars," adding that most of the academic studies of stardom, including Dyer's book on stars and Christine Gledhill's Stardom and Jackie Stacey's Stargazing, and even Edgar Morin's Les Stars, had all been devoted overwhelmingly to Hollywood. This dominance, however, was not just a product of star studies, but was one that circulated in the wider culture, extending, for instance, to the very terms to denote film stars in France itself. Van Sandoz pointing out that the English word star became widely adopted in France during the 1920s, supplanting the French term étoile, which was really only used to designate theatre stars. But film stars in France from 1920 on were called stars, as though it was somehow kind of an American concept or a British concept. Okay. Nevertheless, despite Hollywood's dominance of international film stardom and star studies, Van Sandoz pointed out that French stars have played a crucial role both in the economy of the French film industry and French culture more widely, but also within the international arena. Film stars have become leading ambassadors of French cinema and French culture, particularly French fashion and the French cosmetics industry, one of its biggest industries. Moreover, historically, France can lay claim to being the first country to create international film stars, from Sarah Bernhardt through to Maurice Chevalier and Max Linder, all of whom were making films as early as 1910, star vehicles. These films, moreover, were distributed throughout the world, particularly across the United States. Indeed, in her book, Van Sandoz made the case for the French comedian Max Linder being considered, and I quote her, the first real star of world cinema, even though he's dropped out of mainstream film history and certainly out of star studies. And I have to admit, I've never seen a film by Max Linder. Have any of you? Has anyone seen?
On YouTube.
On YouTube? Yeah. At least someone has. Great. But I think that confirms her point. We all remember Charlie Chaplin, and he's here in town with us, as I said yesterday. But we've completely forgotten about this French comedian from the same period who can be argued to be the first global star, the first world star. Okay. French stardom is important not only because of the international prominence of French stars and the formative role of the French film industry, the formative role it's played in the development of the star system across the world, but also because it operates in a different way to the Hollywood industry. In France, stars and film actors, prominent film actors, have much closer links between film and theatre. They usually maintain those twin careers. They don't give up theatre for film. And also, they typically have greater autonomy. They often set up their own film companies, so become their own producers. They often make more films a year than Hollywood film stars make. And they also feature very prominently on French television. So they tend to be multimedia. They move back and forth between the media, the different media. And they don't give up the others to concentrate on film, which has typically happened up until recently in Hollywood. Okay. This gives French stars a higher public visibility than most Hollywood stars, but it's also given them a greater degree of control over their own image and public profile, with many French stars being notoriously reluctant to engage in promotional tours and interviews for their films. So while they're busy working and they're publicly visible in terms of their work, very often they declare they're not going to do press interviews and stuff like that, which Hollywood stars are contractually obliged to do, whether they like it or not. Van Sandoz notes in her study that French stars tend to make a much wider range of films than their Hollywood counterparts, not getting stuck into a particular genre, and also that they're seldom tied into long-term contracts with particular studios. So they often work with different studios, one after the other. They also tend to sign contracts that give the companies limited jurisdiction over their images and their other activities. So they seldom sign a contract with a film studio that prevents them from working in theatre or with a rival studio or working on television. Whereas before 1960, if you signed a contract with a film studio, you usually had to sign an exclusivity clause so that you couldn't work for anybody else of any other medium, even work on stage. Similarly, French stars attain a high degree of international fame, which comes about partly from working with auteur and art house directors whose films are shown across the world in art house cinemas, and in the case of female stars, through their appearance in international advertisements for France's leading perfume and cosmetics companies. So, for instance, Catherine Deneuve was long associated with Chanel No. 5, and that bolstered her career for a long time. Isabella Gianni was associated with Dior, and Juliette Binoche was associated with Lancôme. Vincent's book includes case studies not only on Max Linder, Jean Gabin, but also Brigitte Bardot, Gérard Depardieu, and Juliette Binoche. And these all demonstrate how important stars have been within the history of French cinema, and how different they've been from their Hollywood counterparts, how different French stars are, and how differently they function from Hollywood stars. Consequently, her socio-cultural study of stars and stardom has added significantly to star studies in general, and it set a trend for a more diverse range of national studies from around the world. Okay. Now, 2002, the year in which Van Sandoz published her book on French film stars, was also the year in which a major collection of studies on European stars was published, focusing specifically on the role of female stars after the Second World War in a number of European countries, unfortunately not Czech. Part of Cassell's Women Make Cinema series, which is edited by Pam Cook and Jeanette Van Sandoz, this collection was edited by Ulrika Sieglor under the title Heroines Without Heroes, Reconstructing Female and National Identities in European Cinema from 1945 to 1951. And this featured essays on major film stars from Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. In her introduction, the editor, Ulrika Sieglor, acknowledged that while the intention behind this project was to expand the international range of star studies, there was, as she put it, a sad irony that this volume may inadvertently create larger exclusivity, given that the five countries chosen here are Western Eurocentric. In particular, she noted with regret the exclusion of Eastern and North European cinemas. The 11 essays contained here form a largely cohesive group, sharing a set of concerns regarding the representativeness of stars as embodiments of national femininity, underpinned by a combination of feminist film theory and new film history. As the editor notes, and again I quote, the essays are at pains to put her story back into history by examining the specific historical context out of which representations of women in the immediate post-war period emerged. She further adds that, and again, I quote, what the theory/history interface allows us to perceive is that while any raw ideological material undergoes processes of displacement and revision during the inevitable transformation into pleasurable fiction, what is displaced or revised and how is governed by specific cultural agendas and imperatives. So, while contributing to the increasing internationalism of star studies, this book also made a valuable contribution to the development of a more historically based and theoretically flexible cinema studies. At the same time, by including two chapters on British stars, Heroines Without Heroes also contributed towards promoting research on stardom within studies of British cinema. Project that would be enhanced the following year, in 2001, by the publication of Bruce Babington's anthology, British Stars, and stardom. Now, in his introduction to this book, Babington notes that, and I quote, "Dominant star theory, even when British in origin, was almost wholly Hollywood orientated, reflecting Hollywood's unquestionable status as the paradigmatic site of stardom." So when we think of stardom, we first think of Hollywood stardom, and then we think about all the alternatives somehow following on from that. Babington notes that the underlying assumption within orthodox accounts of star studies, that the characteristics of the Hollywood star system pertain equally in other national contexts. Babington notes that the underlying assumption within orthodox accounts of star studies is that the characteristics of Hollywood stardom pertain equally to other national contexts. But as he reveals in his introduction, this is not the case with British cinema, as I suspect it's not the case with Czech cinema either. There are definite differences because British cinema is a small-scale film industry, it's a small economy, actors can't work exclusively in the film industry, they have to work in the theatre and they have to maintain strong links with the theatre, and that gives them a different profile and a different opportunity to expand their range as actors. And again, they seldom sign long-term contracts with a particular studio. They usually sign to do a film with a studio in between theatre engagements. Okay. The other thing that he notes is a certain restraint on the part of British stars. So unlike the rather extrovert and showy American stars that we think of as charisma and star quality, somehow a lot of British stars underplay that kind of egotism, what we might think of as egotism. And so he talks about how a number of stars, including James Mason, who goes on to work in Hollywood, of course, and appears in A Star Is Born with Judy Garland, but also other stars like Julie Andrews, who you may know from Mary Poppins or The Sound of Music, or Sean Connery, who you know, may know from some of the early Bond films, all basically underplayed their star status. They never put themselves forward as great stars. They talked about them more as kind of working actors, jobbing actors, and they downplayed the whole glamour and glitz of the star system. Okay, and this Babington sees as being part and parcel of a genuine cultural difference between Britain and America, that the British are much more reserved. I mean, we are, aren't we? I mean, we're just not show-offs in any kind of way, are we? You know. Well, I don't know. Maybe we are. Okay, do we need a break? Can we go on for five more minutes?
Yeah, you can go.
We'll go on 5 minutes, then we'll have a break, because I can feel the temperature rising. Yes. Okay. All right, we'll just stay in Europe for a little while longer, and then we'll have a break. Okay, so just bear with me for five more minutes. It's clear that in the 21st century, the Hollywood-centric approach to star studies slowly began to break down, with some of the most original studies. Thank you. With some of the most original star studies being produced in Europe by European scholars researching European stars. Most notably, Tutti Sawyer's edited collection, Stellar Encounters, published in 2009. This anthology draws together a rich and diverse selection of essays on European film stars, such as Greek stars, Finnish and Scandinavian. And these chapters all originated at a conference of the popular European cinema organisation, which happened in Stockholm in July 2003. And this was dedicated to the task of reclaiming some of the forgotten or neglected stars of Europe in a bid precisely to redress the Anglo-American bias of film studies. As the book's editor declared in her introduction, and I quote, "For the first time in the history of cinema studies, Stellar Encounters, Stardom in Popular European Cinema, explores and collects presentations of a number of different stardoms circulating in the European media constellation. Setting out to question the notion of Hollywood as the originator of the star system and European cinemas being essentially adapters or imitators of that system, many of the contributors to this book examine the distinctive qualities of Europe's various star systems to reveal a multitude of stardoms and star practices. And one of the key questions that emerges from the book is why certain stars are so quickly and thoroughly forgotten, why they become hidden from history, why they disappear from cultural memory after their period of stardom. But the major issue in the book is really the relationship between stars and notions of nationhood, the way in which a particular star personifies, embodies, or incarnates national characteristics. So why a particular Scandinavian star might embody Norway or Sweden. Okay. And that becomes a big issue within star studies from this point on. I think we'll have a break at this point, and then after the break, I'll continue to talk a little bit more about the growing internationalism of stars with the incorporation of Chinese and Indian film star scholarship. But for now, let's get a bit of fresh air, or a cigarette, or have a comfort break.
Be back in 5 minutes, guys.
Shall we? Yeah. Oh, good. Right, so it's all on there. So if
I was watching the last PowerPoint, it's red and it includes Shahrukh Khan.
Yes, it's the one that goes red. I told you, it gets more exciting as we go along.
And it's a great picture, the water dripping.
Yes, that would be nice. Chilled cold water. Thank you.
Tonight in the evening, there's the Beth Davis, and tomorrow for your to be loved for 32.
And in the see them in this building?
Yeah, exactly in this room.
Oh, right.
Because there's, this is the room designed specially for the screening.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a great sound here.
What time is the showing of Dangerous here?
7:10 in the evening. 7:10. 10, which will be starting. Unfortunately, I didn't get any English subtitles. No, it's not. It's English. It's English. But I don't think they're wrong. Because I remember there was, for example, a foreign lecturer who was showing a Russian film with German subtitles, and that was much bigger than I think. So, and tomorrow we will be screening both of the films, Fear to the Lecture, and My Week with Melody, again, Fear to the Lecture.
So up until now, they've only seen A Star Is Born.
A Star
That's
Is Born.
Fine, I can work with
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about A Star Is Born before we break.
Okay.
So I'm going to try and break at 2 o'clock now.
2:05. I will wait.
You'll wait at me.
Yeah.
I'll start waiting.
2:05 and we can give them 15 minutes.
Yeah? Or,
20 minutes.
Or shall we finish at 2 and give them 20 minutes? Or does 2:05 fit in with the usual schedule?
This is exactly what
it's
stated.
Ah, right. It's what they're expecting.
Yeah. 2:05.
Okay, well,
we better
stick to the schedule.
So we can stick to the schedule.
Okay, you wave to me.
Yeah, I will.
Please. Oh, that's lovely and cold. Okay, so I'll continue. Just before I do we have any other Martins in the audience? Are there any other Martins in this room? Just one. Two. There's only three of us in this room on this special day, on our special day, where we're to be celebrated and worshipped by everybody. Okay, well, we're the three guys you must celebrate and worship today, so... Felicitations to you, fellow Martins. I hope you enjoy the day. Okay, 10 years ago, in 2004, Manchester University Press published a collection of new essays under the title of Film Stars, Hollywood and Beyond, which was edited by Andy Willis. And this included essays by Mark Yankovic, Peter Kramer, who I believe you know, Philip Drake, Cynthia Philando, Jane Hurdler, Mark Gallagher and Lisa Taylor, among others. In his introduction, Andy Willis noted that definitions of stardom had become blurred, due in part to the rise of other kinds of celebrity, but also due to various national contexts in which stars emerge and circulate, noting how, for instance, some of the biggest stars in the world were not Hollywood stars anymore by 2004, but were either Bollywood stars, such as Amitabh Bachchan, or Hong Kong stars, such as Jackie Chan. Thus, since 2000, an increasing emphasis within star studies has been placed upon diversity, both in terms of the range of stars being investigated and also the methods that are used to investigate them. This has included stars from many different countries, but also from different modes of cinema, such as cult cinema, exploitation cinema, as well as across various media, most notably television and pop music. So modern star studies now, star studies that have been emerging over the past 10 years, have tended to look at the other media careers of film studies as well. So in a study on a great many stars, they look at their film work, they look at their television work, they look at any work they may have in pop music or somewhere else. Those things are seen to be just as important as their performances in films. Okay, more recently, 4 years ago, in 2012, Mary Farquhar and Yingjin Zhang edited a collection called Chinese Film Stars, which provided a welcome and much-needed addition to star studies literature, producing an historical account of the stars of Chinese cinema from various territories, including Taiwan and Hong Kong, from the silent era right the way through the end of the first decade of the 21st century. And what this book really reflects is the prominence of Chinese stars in the international arena by the 1990s, perhaps most notably Maggie Cheung, Gong Li, Michelle Yeoh, Zhang Ziyi, Jackie Chan, Chow Yun-fat, Leslie Cheung, Jet Li, and Tony Leung. Farquhar and Zhang note that despite the high profile of these popular and award-winning stars, there is, and I quote, a sheer paucity of scholarship on the stars of Chinese cinema, with Chinese stars and stardom rarely receiving what they describe as sustained academic attention in either Chinese or English publications. So their book represented a decisive step forward in depth exploration of stars and stardom in Chinese cinema. Alongside a consideration of the historical context in which Chinese stars are constructed and transformed in relation to changing socio-political conditions, their book also considers issues of gender, identity, performance, and politics specific to individual stars through chapter-by-chapter case studies. And this book is very rich in its selection of different stars, including the Chinese-American star, Anna May Wong, the athletic star, Lee Lilly, and the post-war Sinophone star, Ling Bo, through to the Hong Kong martial arts superstar, Bruce Lee, the international superstar, Jackie Chan, and the Hong Kong icon and all-round entertainer, Leslie Cheung, as well as the new generation superstar action hero, Jet Li. This, the editors claim, constitutes just a small group from a galaxy of Chinese film stars, revealing to a Western readership just the tip of the iceberg. Nevertheless, their anthology provided a very clear demonstration that it's complicated. Chinese stardom is multifaceted, they say. It's long-lived and complicated by history, spectatorship, gender, and politics. And moreover, it's richly endowed with cult icons and subversive figures. Their collection of essays also revealed how stars in China and elsewhere embody multiple meanings that encapsulate the private and the public, the ordinary and the extraordinary, off-screen and on-screen persona, as well as the individual within the contemporary world. And they also write that stars personalize social meaning, cultural identity and ideology for different audiences at different times and in different locations. I wonder if this sounds familiar to you. It sounds to me very Dyerian. It sounds very much like what Richard Dyer was writing about in Stars back in 1979. And in fact, in their introduction, the editors declare that they're adapting and developing Richard Dyer's approach to Chinese star studies. So we kind of come full circle, I think, from Stars, Richard Dyer's Stars in 1979, to Chinese film stars in 2010. These two works are directly linked to each other. Okay. Now, since 2000, while star studies has been expanded to include studies of European and world stars, there have also been some significant new developments in scholarship on Hollywood stars and the star system, most notably in terms of a more sustained and detailed investigation into the recent and contemporary American film industry. And so in 2003, the publication of Contemporary Hollywood Stardom both augmented and updated star studies. Martin Barker, in his introduction to this collection, announced that his and his co-editor's desire was to contribute to the reawakening of star studies after a period in which they've seemed to lose energy that had characterized the early 1980s. Here, he also expressed the belief that stardom itself has changed significantly in the last decade in ways that challenge a number of the ideas that have become common sense in star studies in that early, lively period. So he's saying that really by 2003, we needed a new kind of star studies approach because the whole nature of Hollywood stardom has changed dramatically from the one that Richard Dyer was analysing back in the 1970s. It's now a different beast. And I'll say more about that in a forthcoming lecture. I'll be drawing quite a lot on some of that work, included in Tom Austin and Martin Barker's contemporary Hollywood stardom. I'm just going to move on a little bit more quickly. So the following year, a publication called Stars, the Film Reader, was put together by American authors, editors, Lucy Fisher and Marcia Landy. This drew together a lot of interesting and very diverse work on film stars. It's really poignant, I think, that they chose to put Anna Mae Wong, the Chinese-American star, on the cover. Again, I think that signified an awareness by the editors and their publisher about the importance of diversity. And in terms of going back to Hollywood cinema, we now need to be looking at the non-white, non-hegemonic stars, but looking at more diverse, marginal, ethnically and racially mixed stars from that system to reflect more contemporary issues within film studies. And what's really been happening since the mid-2000s, over the last 9 years, has been, I think, an increasing focus on individual stars. So rather than producing more wide-ranging books that tell us all about the stardom across Europe or across a particular country like Britain or France, there have been more works dedicated to individual film stars. So there's been an increasing focus. So for instance, in 2006, Karen Hollinger published her book, The Actress, Hollywood Acting and the Female Star, which narrows down to a small group of American female film stars: Meryl Streep, Susan Sarandon, Jodie Foster, Angela Bassett, and Gwyneth Paltrow. And here the author charts the rise and fall of their careers. Each star, their career is charted out, so we begin to see the kind of standard pattern that affects female stars working in the American cinema. It identifies breakthrough roles where they've broken through to become stars and gained greater attention. It talks about their initial training before becoming a star, and it talks about their work in other media, such as theatre and television. And it also notes in each case how every actress has been through a process of typecasting, and how each one, to some extent, less so Gwyneth Paltrow, but more or less all the other actresses, have had to engage with issues around ageing and the visibility of their ageing and how that's impacted upon their career. And in so doing, it's introduced a number of key themes about career trajectories and ageing and the management of decline that other star scholars have been picking up. And there's some books currently in the pipeline that are about to be published that are precisely on those issues. Okay, following year, Janine Basinger, very prominent American film historian, published her book, The Star Machine. And again, this contains a series of case studies on individual actors, male and female. And she's chosen these actors mainly to bring to light the careers of a diverse range of Hollywood leading stars from the 30s, 40s and 50s, many of whom who were very big in their day, but have since been largely forgotten about. And so she's trying to reclaim them. And again, I think that reflects this growing interest in reclaiming stars who've slipped through the net of history and are in danger of being forgotten, which is becoming a key concern for a lot of film star scholars. While Basinger set out to write about the system of star making, about what she calls the star machine that evolved at the end of the silent era and created movie stars in the 30s, 40s and 50s, she nevertheless found it necessary to write about individual movie stars. But nevertheless, she says, she resisted the urge to concentrate on the era's legendary figures who have already been written about in many types of books. So she doesn't talk about John Wayne and she doesn't talk about Marilyn Monroe, because she feels they've kind of been done to death. Okay. Another important publication that emerges in around this time, 3 years later, is Mia Mask's book, Divas on Screen, Black Women and American Film, which includes five chapters on Dorothy Dandridge, Pam Grier, Whoopi Goldberg, Oprah Winfrey and Halle Berry. And she's looking at the particular career trajectories of black female stars going back to the 1950s, coming up to more or less the present day, certainly the early 2000s. It's a very important contribution to American film scholarship on stars. Another important development in the last few years, since 2010, has been the publication of a whole series of books, 10 in all, by Rutgers University Press in America, which takes stars, American film stars, decade by decade, starting with the 1910s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and up to the 2000s. And you can see on the cover a snapshot of some of the stars who are included in each of those publications. There's about 12 chapters in each. So although there's only six pictures on the cover, there's another six stars who are also incorporated. So each chapter is devoted to either one star or a combination of two stars who've worked together on a number of film projects. Okay, so again, another really enriching and creating a much more diverse range of star scholarship between the years 2010-2012. In and around this same time, there's been an increasing number of single star studies. And what I mean by that is books devoted to a particular star. So Rachel Mosley's Growing Up with Audrey Hepburn, 2002, was one of the first of these. Adrienne McLean's Being Rita Hayworth, 2005. Lisa Dowling and Sue Harris's From Perversion to Purity, The Stardom of Catherine Deneuve, cover of which you can see on the screen. Amy Lawrence's The Passion of Montgomery Clift, 2010, and Sabrina Yu's Jet Li, Chinese Masculinity and Transnational Film Stardom, which is a wonderful book from 2012. And it's all increasing the focus, but at the same time, it's like there's an explosion taking place in star studies now. Every year there are masses of books coming out, either on a national star industry or on individual stars. And part of that explosion, of course, relates to my own book series that I co-edit with Susan Smith. So since 2012, over the last 2 years, we've been producing a whole series, about three books a year, dedicated to an individual film star. So starting with Pam Cook's book on Nicole Kidman, then my colleague Susan Smith's book on Elizabeth Taylor, Jeanette Van Sandoz's Brigitte Bardot, Lisa Shaw's lovely book on Carmen Miranda, Kerry Walsh's sleazy, seedy book on Mickey Rourke, fabulous. We launched it in New York just over 2 months ago, I think. Anne Davis's Penelope Cruz, and last but certainly not least, Ulrika Sieglor's Hannah Schigler, which we're launching in London in December. More books are set to follow over the next few years, including Denzel Washington by Cynthia Baron next year, and Rock Hudson by John Mercer next year, Julie Christie by Melanie Bell, George Clooney by Paul McDonald, Sean Connery by Andrew Spicer, Amitabh Bachchan, which I'm just reading at the moment, just reading the manuscript, it's wonderful, by Sunny Singh, Madhuri Dixit by Nandana Bose, James Mason by Sarah Thomas, and Tony Leung by Mark Gallagher, and finally, so far, Deborah Carr by Sarah Street. Okay, and this reflects both the internationalism of star studies and the increasing focus on the careers and images of individual stars. But to my shame, I have to admit, at the present moment, we don't have a Czech star on our list. Apologies for that. Star studies, then, has evolved significantly Since the publication of Richard Dyer's Stars back in 1979, it's encompassed a wide variety of approaches and methods, many of which have been inspired by Dyer's work. However, as we shall see in some of the next lectures, there are also studies that have diametrically been opposed to Dyer's work and have taken star studies in very different directions from the cultural studies approach, the socio-semiological approach advocated by Richard Dyer. There we are, star studies. It's messy and it's complicated, but it's rich and it's exciting, and there's a whole world there that you can engage with in lots of different ways and bring your own interests to it, which is why I, for one, love working in it. Okay. So, oh, that little thingy, yeah. Great, yeah, lovely. We need more Judy Garland, I think. More Marilyn Monroe. And a bit of Betty Davis. How about that for a combination? I'm now going to talk specifically about the history of the star system, and I'm going to draw directly on some of that historical work that's been done in the wake of Richard Dyer's study, particularly the work of Jane Gaines, Barry King, and Paul MacDonald, who've looked in more detail at how the industry actually used stars and the conditions under which stars were employed. And I'm going to start out by looking particularly today on the studio era from 1920 to 1960, and then tomorrow I shall look at the era beyond 1960, what we call the post-studio era. Okay. So stardom has been a dominant feature not just of Hollywood but of film industries around the world, and it can be considered in terms of the mechanics of the star system, including the way stars are discovered, developed, deployed, presented and evaluated within the film industry. The system is characterized by star and studio associations, the production of star vehicles, films that are vehicles for particular stars, often associating stars with specific genres, or sometimes developing particular star pairings where two stars are constantly combined in a series of vehicles. So this lecture then is mainly concerned with the economics and business practices of stardom. It looks at the ways in which stars operated within the industrial context of film production, distribution and exhibition between 1920 and 1960. That is, how stars functioned as workers, commodities and capital, something that was owned by an institution, by a corporation. This includes the terms and conditions of the contracts between stars and studios. But it's also about casting practices, particularly typecasting, and the uses of star vehicles as a means of stabilising the demand for film among moviegoers. It'll be seen how a number of major stars have gained greater levels of control over their work by eventually becoming directors and producers, often producing their own star vehicles, certainly towards the end of the 1950s. But between 1920 and 1960, most Hollywood stars were under contract to a particular studio. Greta Garbo, Judy Garland, and Gene Kelly were all under contract to MGM, one of the biggest and most prestigious studios from this period, while Betty Davis, Humphrey Bogart, and James Dean were contracted to Warner Brothers, one of the other big companies, big five Hollywood studios. Now, ever since Hollywood instituted mechanisms to produce and manage stars, contracts have played a vital role in the film industry. In order to retain control and ownership of their talent, Studios employed stars on contracts that could last for up to 7 years, with an annual or biannual option to release the star if they were no longer viable. So either once a year or twice a year, certainly in the first year, a studio could get rid of that star if they weren't working, if their films weren't successful. The star, on the other hand, didn't have the option of leaving the studio until the full term of the contract had expired, unless the studio agreed to release them. So if after 3 years of working with a studio, a star was really unhappy with the way they were being managed or the kinds of films they were being asked to appear in, they couldn't turn around and say, "Can you release me from the contract, please?" Well, they could ask, but they'd usually be told no. So you've got to wait till your 7 years is up. We decide when we get rid of you. So as a star, you have no control. You had to wait your 7 years. And if you decided not to work and say, "Well, I'm not going to work for you anymore, I'm just going to sit here," they would say, "Fine, we shall suspend you without pay. You will receive no income. And remember, you've signed an exclusivity clause, so you are not allowed to work for anyone else." So basically, for as long as you were on suspension, you wouldn't receive any money, and you couldn't work for anyone else, so you couldn't earn any money. So eventually, you would be forced, unless you'd already saved a lot of money, you would be forced to go back to work and endure that work for however many years remained of your contract. So a lot of big stars who were leading these wonderful, glamorous, wealthy lifestyles were actually indentured servants. They were locked in to a form of servitude which gave them very little control. And that gave them very little control over their own image, their name, their voice, their performances. All of that was owned by the studio, who could decide what would be done with those things. So all the major studios at this time, MGM, Paramount, Warner Brothers, RKO and 20th Century Fox, the big five companies, all kept large stables of stars. That's what they called them, stables. How interesting. They talked about them like livestock, like horses, the ownership of horses, from which they could repeatedly cast their films in numerous combinations to ensure consistency on the one hand, novelty on the other. Now, in his book, The Star System, Paul MacDonald writes that within the detailed division of labour that was a defining characteristic of the studio system from 1920 to 1960, stars were, to quote him, categorised as performance specialists who assumed a range of tasks, including reading scripts and learning lines, rehearsal, shooting scenes, which involved repeating takes when required, dubbing or post-synchronization, and promotional activities. And the last thing is really important to bear in mind, promotional activities. As the elite group within the hierarchy of film actors, stars function like any other actor, but they also have additional responsibilities in terms of promotion and generating publicity. And that's why they're paid more than any other actor. Stars are differentiated from other film actors by the level of attention given to them in terms of marketing, promotion, and critical reception, but also in terms of the level of payment they receive. Okay, stars are a very significant investment. A lot of money is put into them, not just through their salaries, but also through their training and development, the way stars were manufactured. And basically, this is how it worked. Initially, talent scouts from the studios would go out and about the cities of America, but particularly New York, sometimes London, Paris, Berlin, and they would search for new stars in theatres and nightclubs. If they found someone who they thought was interested, they would then recruit them. But before they were fully recruited and signed up to a contract, they would have to go through a particular set of hurdles. First and foremost, they would have to pass a screen test. And YouTube is now full of amazing screen tests where well-known actors failed to get their first contract. It's well worth having a look at. Have a look at Rock Hudson's first screen test. It's wonderful. Okay. So screen test. First of all, you had to pass a screen test, which was a very intimidating thing for most performers, particularly coming from theatre, to have to endure. If you passed a screen test, you might be lucky enough to be given an exclusive long-term contract with a particular studio. Once signed, a contract player, as you are now referred to, would receive a weekly wage while undergoing an intensive apprenticeship. And that apprenticeship usually included receiving tuition from the studio's speech and diction coaches to perfect your vocal technique, along with acting classes with a drama coach. And by the late 1930s, virtually all the major Hollywood studios operated their own drama schools, so that actor training and coaching was an important part of the Hollywood studio system of the 1940s. And many of the big stars of this era were constantly required to improve their acting methods year after year. They would continue to receive coaching. Acting teachers taught actors to use scripts as a blueprint for building characterization, while preparation was required to integrate directorial suggestions and to be able to interact effectively with other actors, as Cynthia Baron and Sharon Marie Carnicki write in their book, Reframing Screen Performance. Many of these techniques were based on the teachings of the Soviet acting instructor Konstantin Stanislavski. Stanislavskian principles of script analysis, character development and research, along with the identification and use of identical beats or units of action, formed a vital part of actor training in the studio era Hollywood. And Baron and Carnicki write about this in great depth and detail in their book. It's a brilliant book on screen acting in the Hollywood studio era. Moreover, the particular method of mainstream commercial filmmaking made actor training, experience, and more independent preparation essential, as Baron and Carnicki describe on page 236 of their book. With limited time for rehearsal and with scenes being shot out of continuity, actors needed to arrive on set, prepared, understanding how each scene fits into both the story and their character's development. So you have to have done all your characterization and know what your story arc is and your character arc is before you turn up to record your shoot. And you'll see some of the problems Marilyn Monroe had with that process when she was making The Prince and the Showgirl in London with Laurence Olivier in 1956. In the film, the last film you'll see on this course, My Week with Marilyn, which is a real exposure of what actors, particularly Hollywood actors, went through in terms of actual making, preparing for and making films. In her case, working with her own acting coach, Paula Strasberg, Lee Strasberg's second wife. Okay. But that's only part of it. The acting is only part of being a Hollywood star. So, again, this is how the evolution of stars take place. Once you've had your actor training, you also undergo your makeover. So while many Hollywood actors join the film industry, having acquired a drama school education and theatre experience, some arrived with little background in theatre, very little acting. They may have come from radio, they might have come from vaudeville, or they could have come from some other entertainment, such as sport. So some were swimmers, for instance, like Johnny Weissmuller, who played Tarzan, or Esther Walters. Therefore, they needed to be given a crash course in drama. But besides acting, other lessons included singing and dancing, etiquette, movement, fencing, horse riding, swimming, boxing, and languages. Because all of those different skills would be needed in a variety of films. While undergoing such training, stylists would be consulted about hair, makeup, and fashion. Hair was frequently restyled and dyed. Occasionally, electrolysis was used to change the shape of an actor's hairline, usually to raise the hair back to create a larger forehead, which would make them seem more intelligent. So Rita Hayworth, who'd got a very low hairline, had it raised by at least an inch, I think, to give her a much squarer hairline. And of course, her black hair, because she was of Spanish descent, her black hair was dyed, bleached, and then dyed red, because she became one of Hollywood's legendary redheads. She wasn't naturally a redhead. Eyebrows were also reshaped, false eyelashes were fitted, teeth were capped and enameled. Teeth might be removed to lend greater definition to cheekbones, so taking out the teeth at the back to create more of a definition here when lit by the lights. And in some cases, surgery might be used to realign noses or to remove blemishes to the skin, such as birthmarks. Okay. And you see all of that process, of course, just to remind you, in A Star Is Born, okay, when Esther has to undergo all of that process in her transformation from Esther Blodgett to Vicki Lester, the Hollywood star. And as that example also indicates, renaming was another part of the process. So as well as changing the faces of actors, new recruits were often renamed in order to augment their glamorous new image. While some stars were able to retain their names, especially if those names suited their persona, had an attractive rhythm, and were easy to pronounce and spell in a number of international contexts, then they could keep them. But for instance, Doris von Keppelhoff had to change her name to Doris Day. It reflected her sunny personality much better than Doris von Keppelhoff. And it was easier to put on posters for the graphic designers. And it would have more recognition across the world. And it would make her sound less German or Dutch. Okay. Meanwhile, Lucille Le Sœur found a new name. They couldn't decide on a new name, so they put it out to audiences to vote from magazines, and the readers of the magazines came up with Joan Crawford. Lucille Le Sœur sounded too much like Lucille Le Sœur, which didn't denote very glamorously. Okay. So, the Hollywood treatment was, according to Robert S. Sennett, who writes about this in his book Hollywood Hoopla, ruthless, impersonal, and universal, so that as soon as a name had been agreed upon, a biography would be invented for the newcomer. And that new company, with their new life story, which was invented for them by the publicity departments, would then be sent out to parties, to be seen at premieres, at prestigious nightclubs, usually accompanied by a studio publicist who would try and generate as much media interest in the newcomer as possible and hopefully get their picture taken alongside a major public figure or another star in the papers to excite interest. Whilst all of that was happening, another group of studio executives were trying to find suitable material for the newcomer to appear in on film. And this was all about finding the right type. So in her book, The Star Machine, Janine Vassinger describes the way in which the major Hollywood studios of the 30s to 50s used a three-step process for developing new stars, which was known in the industry as the build-up. The first stage of the build-up was that contract players appeared in bit parts, and walk-ons. Basically, they had no dialogue. They would walk into a scene, do something, and walk out again. So these were small roles. They might have one line or a couple of words, but no more than that. Success at this stage could then lead to speaking parts, so they could then graduate. However, a newcomer's continued casting depended on them being singled out for praise by reviewers or by generating fan mail. Letters coming into the studio from fans who'd seen the film who were commenting on who was that attractive young man or attractive young woman in that scene. Can we find out more about them? Can we join their fan club? Can we please have a photograph? Could we have a signed photograph? Okay, all of that interest would help the contract player or the newcomer graduate towards bigger parts on screen. Okay. All newcomers were subjected to intense scrutiny. For instance, research companies were hired by studios to study and assess their performers' popularity using a variety of methods. Okay, stage two was if the contract player received positive feedback in terms of fan mail, box office receipts, star ratings, and marquee value, then, as Basinger writes, the system really went to work. During the second stage of the build-up, the studio's publicity department would be set in motion, with the newcomer's fake biography and studio portraits being planted by publicists in a range of publications. Often this included female cheesecake or male beefcake images being put into circulation, featuring the starlets and young male stars appearing in scantily clad beachwear, exposing their shapely figures, particularly legs, waists, arms and shoulders. Newcomers would be introduced also, physically introduced, to the editors of the popular magazines, such as Photoplay, Modern Screen, Screenland and Movie Stories and Screen Album, some of the most popular fan magazines of this period, and interviews would be set up with reporters and gossip columnists, most notably Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper, the gossip queens of Hollywood, who could make or break a career overnight. In between all of these photo shoots and interviews, the newcomer would test out their newly acquired performance skills in leading roles opposite other newcomers or in supporting roles opposite big stars. If they received good reviews and proved popular with audiences at previews, they would graduate to the third and the final stage of the star-making process. I'll just quickly run through what the third stage was, and then we'll break. So finally, the third stage of the build-up consisted of a newcomer, being cast in a leading role in their own vehicle in an attempt to establish their appropriate type. In other words, a role that best suited their image and persona, which had the greatest appeal for audiences. Janine Basinger notes that this final stage of the build-up usually involved three types of film. Firstly, the actor was noticed by audiences. Secondly, their perfect type was discovered. And thirdly, the favoured role was repeated in film after film. Okay, so just very briefly, Marilyn Monroe had a name change from Norma Jean. When she was signed under contract by 20th Century Fox, she became Marilyn Monroe because it sounded better and classier. And again, it had nice rhythm and intonation that kind of reflected her personality. She had her hair dyed. She wasn't a blonde until after 1947. So they gave her a new image. She got a new backstory, a new biography. She was taken around the nightclub. She met and consorted with all these sleazy guys who owned and edited these journals, these popular fan journals and magazines. She was put in bit roles in 1950, including a walk-on part in a Bette Davis film called All About Eve in 1950. She appears in just two scenes She's electric. You can't take your eyes off her. It got an amazing response. And after that, she graduated to supporting roles in The Asphalt Jungle, opposite Hayden Sterling. And by 1952-53, she was getting top of the bill roles alongside Betty Grable and Lauren Bacall in How to Marry a Millionaire. So she was now a starlet. She's not quite a star, but she's a starlet. She's up there, appearing with the big names. Okay, so she's got a new name, she's been physically remodeled, and she's gone through the walk on bit part, three-stage build-up, to graduating to now finding her type. And at this point in 1953, her type is the dumb blonde. Okay, that is her type. That's where we're at. Okay, we'll have a break now, and then we'll continue with this, talking about the contract system, but also introducing you, if you don't already know her, to Bette Davis. Okay?